Hey guys, welcome back to Pre-Production. Thank you so much for listening once again. I have a wonderful guest this week. Her name is Zelda Williams. She is an actress and a director. Her directorial debut, Lisa Frankenstein, is currently available on video on demand across all platforms. It's a wonderful, charming little movie, and I think it's just fantastic. And I cannot wait to see what else she does. I know she has a lot planned. She's also been a voice actress in things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Legend of Korra. She's appeared in Criminal Minds and all kinds of television shows. Thank you so much, Zelda, for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Obviously, you're someone who's had, you know, the industry sort of around you for most of your life. But I know that you've told me that having the ability to actually live in San Francisco when you were younger, that you were kind of separated from sort of the noise of it all a little bit. I'm curious, at what point did you sort of start to feel like there was a possibility in regards to film and telling stories, or a desire to do that in yourself?
Growing up in San Francisco, the nice thing about it in navigating the industry is I saw a very specific, obviously, very privileged aspect of it, because most of the movies my dad filmed in San Francisco were with Chris Columbus, who was one of his closest friends. So those collaborations might have given me, especially younger, a very skewed idea of how film works, because I will say, even in this industry, they're not that common. And they're certainly worth aspiring to, you know, Scorsese working with friends over and over again. A lot of those directors really did for a long period of time, but I wasn't aware of the fact that that was as uncommon necessarily as it was from that perspective, and also not navigating the Hollywood social life of it all. You know, San Francisco didn't have that kind of sphere. I didn't really understand the aspects of the industry that I do think tend to be the most toxic. The expectations of a certain performance, particularly in public, was something my dad never really was good at, and nor did he like. So it's why we were raised there. And my mom certainly didn't like it. She's very private. So it kind of did give me, it gave me a very false and sheltered perspective. But it also gave me a really dreamlike one that I still earnestly hang on to as well, which was about, you know, the friendships that you can repeatedly foster and work in a creative environment with, and also the sets that I will say are very uncommon these days, where there was all this really beautiful production design work and costume design work. That's become even more rare. And that was already a fairly rare thing, even in the 90s. But, you know, now with green screens, with those, the LED, it's kind of the outdoor-indoor thing. There's incredible technological advances, but sometimes at the expense of a certain sort of tactile touchability that I think I personally miss in a lot of movies. It's not, there's a lot of people going back to practicality now, which is nice to see. And there's certainly a lot of usage for the technology where you can still blend practical with some of this new magic. But a lot of the stuff that's completely technological, I just did not grow up around. Those were not the movies being made. So that was another aspect that I had to understand more as I came into the industry myself and kind of left that side of it.
I think you had mentioned once in an interview that I saw that it was somewhere around the time of Bicentennial Man that you began to sort of take the notion of filmmaking a little more seriously.
The deeper concept of a job, at least not in our generation, certainly in our grandparents' generation, they were working by that age. But, you know, I didn't understand that it was necessarily going to be a thing that you had to spend your life learning until a bit later. But it was certainly something I was interested in by that point. And I will say as well, you know, there's still even parts of this that I'm learning on a day-to-day basis. I think the funniest job on a set, just by name alone, not because of what they do, is best boy.
I knew you were going to say best boy. Every time I see best boy in the credits, I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
It just makes me smile every time I see it. But, you know, that was the beginning of my fascination, certainly. And, you know, again, Chris fosters such a wonderful set environment. And those were a lot of what I grew up on, because unlike a lot of the sets, which I didn't travel to unless I was off school, in San Francisco, I was going to school and was able to go and visit set when I wanted to and see dad. And so those sets were a lot more accessible to young people. Chris's kids are my age as well. So like they're my age, my little brother's age. So we went to school together in the same class too. So we would like leave school when we were done for the day and like go and visit them on set. It was the beginning of me understanding A, that sets could be kind of so comforting in a way, like they were run so beautifully. And again, this is with the glossiness of childhood memory, but Chris is a really talented, incredible director who does tend to run a very calm set and a very family-oriented set. So I saw that as certainly an aspirational element to film. But it wasn't until I kind of moved out here and started acting myself that I got a deeper understanding as well of the various different aspects of it. And the fact that particularly in the directing sphere, as I started to pursue it, I did want to run it a lot more in that familial way than as a sort of like tense auteur. There are, of course, very kind auteurs too, but I will say when you get exacting with a vision, it can be exacting on other human beings as well. So yeah. I did tend to lean a bit more of this kind of collaborative familial environment because it was what I was raised around. I don't think when you're younger, you really even understand that you can be a director when you get older. I mean, you understand, but you're not really aware of what it's going to take. But I did know I could go and act. So that's why I pursued acting first. And I'm grateful I did. I think it helps to communicate with your actors in every possible sense, even if you're not like, you know, I was never Robert Downey Jr., but I was an actor that really loved my job and studied hard. So being around other actors now is much easier.
For sure. I'm reading this book right now by Ed Zwick, and it's all about his directorial career from 30-something Glory to Last Samurai. And while he was on this show, he decided that he would just sort of play a therapist in one scene. And that he thought that would be simple. And it would be like, oh, I just have to sit there and listen and occasionally say something. And he was across Evan Rachel Wood. And he describes his first experience being an actor as walking onto set and suddenly noticing how bright the lights are, how they're like, you can feel the heat of it on your skin. The notion that like 50 people are looking at you, waiting for you to do something. And you're also remembering that there's lines that you have to hit and that they have to feel natural, and that it just absolutely instantly gave him this monumental amount of respect for actors that he admitted that he had never had before. And so I think you're absolutely right. The idea of being able to understand what it feels like to be on both sides of the camera is going to make you a better filmmaker.
Yeah, I think particularly with directors, you know, directing is such an actor's job in a weird way. You have a DP that oftentimes, and that depends on how much you trust them to deliver what you're hoping, but I would hope that you've hired people that you trust. That's kind of the whole point. I do think that the DP is more in charge of how things look, whereas a director really does need to be in charge of the acting, the tone, not because you need to be policing any of it, but because you do need to be guiding it. So particularly if you're dealing with directors that consider themselves more visual, I've often found that their communication with actors is really low, and it takes a very particular confident actor to work through that. Some of them are fabulous at it, and they just know that that's what they were hired for, and they run with it. But I've seen other ones get extremely self-conscious in the lack of guidance, the lack of communication, the lack of kind of the dialogue to keep the tone of a film in its particular sphere can be really hard for actors. So it's pretty funny. Hi, Goji. My dog just came to say hey. It can be pretty interesting, especially these days, what we were mentioning before, a very green screen oriented set. And you'll see more actors talking about how their experiences on certain very, you know, usually large budget spectacle kind of movies was very jarring for them because they had to act opposite a tennis ball, or they had to imagine that all this stuff was happening that you obviously cannot see. In those situations, if you are dealing with a director that's also not giving you any sort of guidance toward anything and just leaning on the idea that they can fix it in post, I do find that that's a lot of the times where I'm watching audiences really disconnect with these large tentpole things is because of that. They hired people that are almost more of a video game designer, which is still an incredibly valid way to approach things. But if you're not also able to communicate with your actors, it can lead to an enormous amount of alienation.
And I think the same thing applies to just the enjoyment of the stories themselves from the audience perspective. If you are watching a story that perhaps you've seen 1,000 times and you know the ins and outs of the plot, but it's just being told in a different way. If you care about the characters and it feels like there's an emotional connection to them in some way, you tend to kind of go with it and want to see the way the story resolves, the same for an audience as it would be on set for a director who is actually in tune with the emotion and the tone of the moment and making sure that no matter what's happening, you're sort of with the characters and feel what they're feeling. And I think it works both ways. And we'll get into Lisa Frankenstein in a second and how I think you did that really well. But I'd love to kind of know, I know a little bit about this just from talking, that you've had a struggle to get a first film off the ground, that it wasn't just like a 1-2 punch kind of thing and we're done. It took a lot of years to get moving. And I'm curious from your perspective, what those sort of years were like trying to get something off the ground and get started.
I imagine they're not too dissimilar from what most filmmakers have to navigate, minus the fact that I also come from a very privileged background. So, you know, that sort of patience was, of course, aided by the fact that I knew I was going to be okay. So I always preface it with that, because an enormous amount of the burnout a lot of creatives feel comes from that, from the other side of that. So my story will never be particularly relatable to all parties, but you know, in the sense of getting a first feature done is always hard. Yes, unfortunately, that is true. This wasn't also supposed to be my first feature. There were three other ones, one of which I wrote and two of which had been that found their way to me that were going to happen before Lisa. You can mourn them or you can miss them and all this stuff. But I found, especially even with acting, I was like, if it didn't happen, if you didn't step on the set and get into that, it was never real in the first place. So I had to move on from those quite quickly. And Lisa was the weird one that survived, which terrified me, because I will say the other ones were a little bit more predictable, is not the word, but a tone that I think is more common right now. And anyone will tell you in this industry, as much as people will say they want to be unique, my mom and dad raised me to understand something about the industry that I hold very dear, which was everyone in Hollywood is trying to do the new unique thing for the second time.
That's absolutely beautiful and incredibly, you know, from my limited perspective, incredibly true.
So that was what was really terrifying about Lisa. Not that it's wholeheartedly unique. I think it harkens back to a time in Hollywood that I'm very fond of. However, it's just not been approached recently. If you're in an ice cream parlor, you're not going to get mad that they serve pistachio ice cream, even though you hate it, right? But weirdly, with film, we navigate it that way, or at least not the royal we of like you and I and filmmakers, but like people that just love watching movies, they'll get viscerally mad that a flavor that they don't want is somehow in theaters. I've seen it. And while I won't necessarily say I understand, it is part of, I think, a fear that a lot of filmmakers wind up navigating. Is, oh, if I make something specific, I'm going to have to stand my ground a lot more. With this, I was really terrified, and have my fears came to reality when I was navigating conversations with people, like not so much me back and forth with them, because you don't really have to defend or explain your art. But I was watching people be like, oh my God. And the editing was so slow. And you're like, well, it was 80s. On purpose. The script was 80s and this is how it was written. And so I wanted it to edit like the 80s. Now you can like that or not like it. That's completely fine. But it wasn't because I made a mistake. Because I don't know how to edit it quicker.
Absolutely.
There's a purposefulness. So that was, I mean, long story short, that was kind of why Lisa terrified me, but also why I'm really glad I did it first. I will say, like, I don't think a lot of the things that I plan on doing are quite as tonally edgy as Lisa wound up being. Most of them will still be edgy because I just have a really dark sense of humor. But
yeah,
the weirdness of this movie, I'm glad I actually got it under my belt first, because nothing can prepare you for like 50% of people that reviewed your film hating it and then 50% of people loving it. Nothing prepares you for that kind of polarization. you navigate it and you realize you're going to survive and it's fine. But in the moment, you're like, what the fuck?
The idea of being afraid of reactions or wondering what someone will think of something you did. I mean, it's obviously on my brain as well. I mean, it's something that every artist is always thinking about, unfortunately, somewhere in the back of their mind, it's like, you know, at some point, this is not going to be just this really great experience that I shared with other people. And at some point, it's going to become colored by public reaction, and I'm going to have to live with that. And it's something I think about more often than I wish I did. And I think that, but from your perspective, like, I mean, I understand how much fun it was to make Lisa Frankenstein from what you've told me. And I felt that while watching it. And I don't think it's just because I was like rooting for you or whatever. Like, I genuinely really enjoyed this movie. And I also am well-versed in 80s movies and understand the sort of way they flow. And one of the things I really loved about it was something that I've heard you talk about before, which is sort of earnestness and sincerity and being what you are about. You are about what you're about, and you're not looking at the audience and going, well, that just happened, or some kind of, you know, wink to the camera that, yeah, we know our plot is absurd, and I hope that you accept that because we're so serious nowadays and we don't want to be mocked. Your movie is what it is. When, as you call him, the creature shows up, played by Cole Sprouse, Catherine Newton isn't like, what the fuck? She's like, oh, hey, come up to my room. It's cool. It's cool up there. That's where all my stuff is, you know? I love that the characters were so willing to accept something so supernatural and insane and sort of roll with it and kind of bypassing all of that angsty shit of like, what does this mean for my life and stuff? And just getting right to the idea of this guy's in my house and let's just have fun with it. And I think that's really charming. And, you know, as fear-inspiring as it probably was to release a movie like that first, like you said, sort of a big swing, I think that you established yourself as a voice, someone who is out there that has something to say. And instead of maybe like you could have done, like you said, maybe something a little more familiar, I think now like more people will be excited about your future prospects because you sort of announced yourself as someone who is willing to do different things.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the interesting thing about all of it as well is like the specificity in this is multi-layered. It's not only a period piece and it's a comedy and it has monsters and there's all this stuff to it. So nothing that I do moving forward will likely, it's not like you get three of these in a row, you know? You get like one of these and then you do a bunch of really different things, which I'm very excited by. But something that you mentioned, I do think was a really big important aspect of this for me, which was earnestness, but also, you know, right now, the sense of humor, especially by nature of where we're at globally, politically, you know, people are so, when they're in a sort of depressive place, it does tend to need to have this sort of nihilism, you know, need might not be the best word, but it tends to have a meta nihilistic sort of laugh at oneself, laugh at the joke, laugh at the circumstance, the situation. And you can see that even in some 80s movies. Ferris Bueller was the example that came to mind that is a lot more, obviously, even, you know, they break the fourth wall, he's looking into camera, but there was still an earnestness to it. And I feel like it is one of the things that I miss a lot when dealing with comedy these days, is allowing for the subject to just be the way that they are. It doesn't need to be explicative. It doesn't also even need to be aspirational. Like, I don't want young girls to go around murdering people. It's not what this movie is about. So her earnestly being as twisted as she is, I think is a very helpful aspect of that. Because the second that you start excusing it or explaining it, I think you start trying to look at other people a bit too much in the eyes and be like, this is for you.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's okay to just be entertained by this. Or, by the way, to not be. One of the things that I wish I'd known more of and been able to ask more peers about before this happened is not the preparation for failure, because there's no real point. You know, if you're worrying about something that you can't prevent, then you're just suffering twice. It's more so that I wish I'd had the awareness to talk to my peers about polarization. That there's not really so much that you should fear about that. As much as we all think that like criticism or critique is negative, it's not really. And I'll explain, I mean, a little bit as to why, because most of the time it's not even for you. People can pretend that they're saying something that they think is going to help a filmmaker. It's really not. Most of the time, that criticism is for other viewers, potentially, who are going to listen or they're not. You can't change a film that's already come out. So that criticism isn't really for you. Maybe you'll learn a lesson about your pacing or something for the next movie. Maybe. But also, it's fine if you don't. If you want to keep making weird shit that isn't for everyone and you find a way to do it, just do it. A lot of my favorite movies now, in having navigated what I went through and was confused by, because I didn't think I made that anarchistic of a film, but apparently it did really split people. When I looked back, I realized that there were a lot of movies that I genuinely loved that had like 43% or this whole algorithmic thing now where I went, oh, well, that doesn't change the fact that I loved it.
Chris Columbus, his film Home Alone, despite how successful it was at the box office, I remember when I was younger, I looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes and it was rotten. And it's not anymore because our generation has sort of embraced it. Same with The Sandlot. I loved The Sandlot as a kid. I went on the Rotten Tomatoes and it was split. And I'm like, how? And I remember the consensus. It stuck in my mind. The consensus was that it was derivative and sweetly nostalgic. And I was like, what movie is like The Sandlot? What, like, is there another movie where like a bunch of kids play baseball and chew tobacco for the first time?
Like,
yeah, and then run away from a monster dog. Like, I don't remember a movie like that. I'm sorry. So I agree with you completely. And this is coming from someone who's been involved in the film critic world for over 10 years now. And I've seen it evolve from the days of Ain't It Cool News to the days of YouTube to TikTok and where it's all kind of gone. There's so much noise now. There are so many people all talking about their opinion. You know, when I started my YouTube channel, there were like 5 people on the platform talking about movies, if you can imagine. Literally like 5.
Thankfully, I think the accessibility to film these days, I don't think is a bad thing. I talk about this a lot where I get that streamers are not necessarily positive, and especially watching these massive conglomerates unilaterally delete art, I have enormous problems with. However, the idea that like these days a kid could find their way to incredible Japanese cinema, incredible Korean cinema, African cinema, like stuff that they were not able to find before unless you were really lucky or you had the money to go and be a collector, which obviously a lot of children don't anyhow. So this proliferation of international cinema, of all of these really cool things, I think that's really positive. However, the one side effect of it that I do find is, and I might get some shit for this, but I've openly said this before, so whatever, they'll navigate it, they'll deal with it. I'm not telling them they have bad opinions. I'm just saying it's the beginning of an academic discovery. So it reminds me of when I meet students who are in like their first or second year of film school, who are awesome and curious and excited. However, they're still at the beginning of usually trying to curate what they like and what they don't like. And a lot of that tends to be based on what they think their teachers and their peers will respect in terms of an opinion. There's always a couple of like devil's advocate kids in there too, but like most of the time, a lot of what they're trying to do is curate what they think will get a response. It makes sense that a lot of them are trying to do this dance, right? It's not a bad opinion, but I will say that like curating anything for an audience will naturally shift the way that you approach even taking in cinema, even your enjoyment of it. It's that, like, it's kind of the Schrodinger's cat of it all, where it's like by nature of being watched, it changes. Mm-hmm. So all of these people who could have done this exploration without the expression of opinion as well. It's completely fine that they're doing it with, but I'm just saying if they had done it without it needing to be expressed to an audience, I have a feeling their opinions would be very different. And they do tend to want to tear things down because, again, with social media, it's already scientifically been explored that negative gets more response. It always has. Positive does tend to be just acknowledged and then moved on from. If they want interaction, they tend to have to be negative. It's created weirdly, kind of like the film group in high school sort of thing. And I'll watch people from either side of this very, it's like the Grand Canyon. It might be vast and it might be deep, but it does connect at a certain point. So why are you guys pretending like you're on other ends of the world? But they fight with each other. And I'm like, you guys like the same shit. You kind of do. You're pretending you don't because you think that this is pretentious and you think that this isn't art. It's all art. So it's like, you kind of just want to look at everyone and be like, just keep enjoying the movies that you are so blessed to have, like, millions of them. Completely fine if you want to be a negative Nancy. We've proven that that gets a lot of people's, you know, attention. But understand that enjoyment is entirely subjective. You can try and convince people of stuff, but I find the surest way to get people to watch something is with your earnest excitement, not with criticism or aggression. You can convince people not to watch something, but what would be the point? If you want to convince people to watch something, being earnestly like the biggest fan of it is the way that happens.
Also, I think what you just said is that I think you don't actually have to work that hard nowadays to convince somebody to not watch something, because people are, all right, whatever, I don't have to watch it. It's an effort now for so many people to find the time to watch a movie or a television show. You don't have to work that hard to say, don't watch something. You got a million things you can watch. It is actually harder to convince somebody to watch something. To say, hey, this is great. This will actually impact you. This will change your life. This will at least entertain you. That's the hard thing. You got like 1,000 things to scroll through. Choosing the one to watch is actually the challenge. You can pass by 10,000 different movies and go, no. Heard that was bad, but that was bad. It's harder to say, guys, this is good. Seek this one out.
It's easy to say these things as well in the immediate moment. Right. So like you and I sitting here talking, or people online writing back and forth to each other immediately. Most of this lacks, as human nature kind of dictates, most of it lacks the awareness of time. Movies change over years, over decades, as people rewatch them, as they become something that becomes a remnant of another moment. The only thing that I've found that can really tell you if you did create something that isn't just such a time capsule that no one ever even really watches it again. They don't want to relive that moment. They don't, you know, is rewatchability. It was the only real comfort I even found in navigating this first experience when I was so confused initially by being like, wait, I didn't think I made anything that weird or edgy, but here we are, was meeting people that had seen it 6 times already. And I was like, why? Why did you watch this weird movie 6 times? But it was because, as we mentioned earlier, it was a flavor they missed or liked or whatever, and it didn't really matter if other people hated it. And as I started to unpack, like, the movies I rewatch, that, you know, I got especially scared when I had to do the Letterboxd thing, because you're like, again, this is like, why are there people that want to know what movies I rewatch a lot? But I was really honest with myself and went like, what do you actually seek out, like, once a month, once whatever? And I really did settle on the ones that I find myself going back to over and over again, because no matter when they were made, clearly there's something in there that you in the present and you potentially in the future, if you plan on owning them and rewatching them again, is taking with you. And that's the thing I think streamers could do well, because it's so available to you, but they do tend to hide stuff from you, to remove stuff. So that rewatchability is now dying. And I think it's why people are going back to buying DVDs and just liking what they like, because they don't want to be reliant upon this massive, monstrous company that they, granular as an individual, don't matter to. Like, you don't matter to a huge company. They could delete your favorite show tomorrow. And yes, it would break your heart, but they don't care. So you kind of have to start collecting again in the way that we grew up doing. So like your massive wall of beautiful DVDs behind you, I'm watching more and more people do that now and demand that now, the Blu-ray, the DVD, even of like niche movies that we didn't do well in theaters. We did okay, especially for a movie that was only like $16 million. We did okay. We didn't do great, but it's been still really comforting to have people reach out and be like, we want the Blu-ray. Where's the DVD? I bought the vinyl. And you're like, oh, we found those people. And I'm curious to see what that looks like in 10, 15 years, because you never know.
I think your movie will absolutely have a good legacy. Ever since I was a kid, when I went to the theater, I think if I were to just sort of boil down my ultimate desire for seeing a movie in a theater, it is to experience escapism. It's to go there and be swept away by a story and forget about everything else except for that story. And if a miracle happens, you forget you're watching a movie for a while. And you know, which is tough to do, especially after you kind of know how the goose is cooked, so to speak. But when I line up for movies that feel like someone is actively trying to tell me a story and take me on a journey. You know, I 100% can see that with Lisa Frankenstein, not just in your direction, but with Diablo Cody's wonderful script, that, you know, you guys both cared about telling the story in a way that other people just weren't really doing anymore.
Well, and then one, you know, I wouldn't call it a regret because I don't really have any. I've made lifelong friends on this and people I'll continue to collaborate and work with. The one thing that I will say people clocked that they're not incorrect about is it was an R-rated movie and they made us make it PG-13. But that happens. That's not, you know, that's a really common thing in the industry. I wouldn't even say it's one of the like necessary hardships of our industry. It's just what happens, especially if you're going to release something in theaters, which is a rarity these days. Looking back, there are jokes and things that I wish were still in the film because I think that was even further where I wanted to go. However, I had a very niche specific goal with this film. And I would not be necessarily what most people would think of when they make a movie, but I just remember it so distinctly growing up. I went to the Jared Padalecki, like Paris Hilton, House of Wax movie in theaters.
Nice.
I remember also, like, you know how Paris sold those shirts that were like, watch Paris die or something?
I remember that.
Right. So it was like a cultural thing, right? But when you were in theaters, there was this really specific moment, which is not what most of the time when you're making like a horror film or like a violent comedy, whatever. It's not what you usually see happen much anymore, but it was common at the time, where when Paris died, everyone in the theater was like, yeah, and they were like laughing and cheering. And I remember so distinctly how fun that felt to be in a movie theater where people were like guffawing and laughing and clapping. It wasn't a dead serious interaction. It was this camp collective thing. And I really wanted that scene, I mean, spoiler, but with Michael Trent, his whole scene at the end, I wanted that to happen. And I remember the first test screening we did very distinctly, and they give you the like screener where it's, you can see the people on the small corner of it, and I was waiting for that scene, being like, oh no, and they all started like cheering and clapping, and a couple people were like standing up and laughing, and I'm like, great, if nothing else, even if there's a bunch of people that'll be mad they didn't see this in theaters, whatever the case may be, if nothing else, for the people that did see it and enjoy it, every single one of them that I've spoken to had that moment. And I'll hang on to that forever. Yeah. Like, I'm good. I took the thing from it that I needed. They can't take that from you.
No.
Even if there are things that you're like, yeah, you know what? Some of these cuts where we had to make something PG-13, not my favorite. But also, I still got to put that in theaters. And that remained untouched.
It's sort of strange because I have a unique perspective on this PG-13 thing. Because I was raised in an environment that was very authoritative about what movies I was allowed to see. And including even in PG-13, you know, I wasn't allowed to watch them uncut until I was 13. And I would have to see them on TV edited for content. Same with, like, you know, I saw Die Hard for the first time on AMC. You know, I saw Die Hard 2 for the first time when he's saying Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon on TV ads. You know, like, but Lisa Frankenstein being PG-13 would have allowed me, when I turned 13, to go see it. And so I feel like there's also a whole generation of people, probably young girls, who are will be older and be like, oh yeah, I got to see Lisa Frankenstein. I remember that. That was one of the more bloody first PG-13 movies I ever saw. That movie had things I never saw before. I think that that's kind of also going to be really fun for people like that who maybe never would have been able to see it before, and who will remember it as one of those gateway movies into a slightly more edgy or gory experience for them.
Potentially. I mean, it'd be lovely whoever needs it and wants it and just wants the laugh. Like, my friend went to the theater the other day and he was laughing his ass off because the entire row in front of him was drag queens in full regalia, like with the wigs and everything. And he ended up having to move one seat over because one of the wigs was too tall. Like, he's like, I haven't gone to a movie where this is like the audience that is here having fun. And he remembers leaving too at the end, and they're like, I don't know, it could have been gayer. And I'm like, yeah, believe me, I would have happily made it gayer. They made me cut already. But I still love that that's who kind of was finding it, who was there. I've met a whole bunch of really interesting women that I would say, you know, they're very goth presenting as well. One of whom came up to me at the premiere and said, thank you for making a death positive movie. And I was like, you're going to need to explain that to me because I don't really know what that means. And she was talking about she's a mortician. And she works on, you know, putting bodies back together again for presentation after the fact. Her mind went to that place of like, she's putting creature together again. And, you know, all this stuff. And I went, again, not at all where I was coming from, but amazing that that's where it wound up. You have no control. Filmmakers, writers, as much as we would like to believe we have control, you don't really. You have as much control as like a ship captain does on the ocean. Yeah, you can guide it a certain direction and there's a place that you hope you wind up, but the ocean is far more powerful and the tides and the currents are going to take you places that you're just going to have to go with it and just make sure that your crew and everyone gets there safely. Like, that's it. You have very little actual control. You have problem solving on your boat and that's it. And I like that now I can look at other filmmakers and I can talk to them and be like, hey, it's going to be okay. Even if like 100 people tell you to your face that they hate your fucking movie, chances are you are also going to find the people that love it.
Yeah.
The people that love this movie are hilarious. I love them so much. Perfection literally doesn't exist. And the pursuit of it, it's fine if you want to be that person, but it will drive you mad. Even when they talk about the Oscars and things, and I know that some people get mad at me for being as down on the kind of awards season circuit as I am. I don't hate it. I think it can reward amazing upcoming filmmakers and help them make their career. Like, I get that there's validity to aspects of it. But the other side of it, the kind of peacocking and the pageantry of it all, because it is ultimately a pageant, I don't think helps anyone because they'll sit here being like, see, it won Oscars, therefore it's a movie worth respecting. And you're like, who gives a shit? Like, there's so many movies that are unbelievable and no one ever gave it a golden statue and all of these people are fine. And they continued to make wonderful movies. They never needed that. You can be as valid just from having like your mom and a couple of your friends loving your shit and then you'll find people.
When I was a kid and I was making short films, this is pre-YouTube, so my audience was the people who made the movie with me and my parents and my sisters, and that's it. I made the movie. I was like, okay, that was great. I edited the movie on iMovie on my old ass giant blue Macintosh, and I would show it to like 6 people, and that's it. Nowadays, you know, like we said, there's the audience is so vast and so wide for everything. But again, this book I'm reading by Ed Zwick, he did win the Best Picture Oscar as a producer for Shakespeare in Love, but he was also nominated for other films that time has kind of put in a slightly better place than that movie, like Glory, you know, and there's even films that he wasn't nominated for that, again, have had better rewatches, so to speak, over time, like Legends of the Fall or even The Last Samurai.
I love Last Samurai, by the way. I'm a Last Samurai stan. I know it was kind of like talked down on for a while. I fucking love that movie.
The Last Samurai is a 10 out of 10 A+ movie. I reviewed that, I don't know how many years ago, gave it an A+. It's an absolutely wonderful film. I will go toe-to-toe with anyone who says otherwise for the rest of my life. And after reading his book, you should read it. I have so much more respect for just the making of that movie. He had like intense, deep sciatic pain for the entirety of the battle shoot at the end. He ended up having to get surgery. Like, the amount of things that they went through to make that movie and to get it made. He talks about, like, and not to talk about Last Samurai, let's just talk about Last Samurai. Like meeting Ken Watanabe and working with him and sort of like he talks about how he was nervous at first and that Ken was like in debt to like the Yakuza and all this crazy shit. And they're making this movie. You know, I think that that's a wonderful movie. But to your point, time really is the ultimate factor for whether or not what a movie's life looks like. People talk about a movie. People keep it in the conversation. The right people share it with each other. Word of mouth, whatever. Lisa Frankenstein is absolutely a movie that will receive that, just as Jennifer's Body did. I reviewed Jennifer's Body a few years ago, and I love that movie. But I decided that I would rewatch and reread reviews from when it was released, just to give myself a historical context. Without a doubt, it's one of the most eye-opening experiences I ever had, because almost every single one of them were about Megan Fox and the perception of her at the time publicly or whatever. Very few people talked about Karen Kusama's filmmaking. Very few people talked about the merits of the script. it was such a reactionary MTV VH1 sort of like pull quote thing.
Ours is hilarious because we don't have someone like that in it. So they did get very like, there was one that was really funny to me. And I don't really like reading them, but I do love occasionally seeing like the most, not aggressive one. I find humor in any reactionary thing, I find doesn't tend to come from an academic place. Most of the time it comes from something else usually. And I find that emotional thing curious for me. So there was someone who was like genuinely mad. Reading it and being like, wow, why did our zombie teenage romance movie upset you this much? Can you show us on the doll where I hurt you? But like, I found it really fascinating that someone was like, she should never direct. And I'm like, sorry to disappoint you, I'm not gonna stop. I do have a book for you because I know we're wrapping up soon, but given that you're talking about this Wick book, I always tell filmmakers about this one because it's just a very specific, I'll just explain what the book is and then you'll understand why I'm like, it won't really ever apply to anything that you're making, but there's something really beautiful about that. So it's called Waiting on the Weather. Teruyo, oh God, I'm going to ruin her name. I know it. And I've met her, Teruyo Nogami, who worked on all of Kurosawa's movies, starting with Rashomon.
Wow.
And she was his scripty and continuity. She wrote a book.
And you met her?
I did, yeah.
Oh my God.
Drank me under the table in Japan. It was really fun.
You do a whole episode just on that meeting.
This book is, especially for women coming into the industry, but for anyone coming into the industry, it's a really fascinating cross-section about this person who's considered, as we're talking about, like a legendary filmmaker, a filmmaker's filmmaker, all of this stuff. But the human portrait of it, about his rages and about the things that went wrong, like Rashomon burning down, like all of this stuff, it's really great for filmmakers to get to read that and realize that you can deify people that came before you, the Kubricks, the Kurosawas. You can put them on a pedestal if you want. Ultimately, they were and are humans. They're fallible. They get self-conscious. They made incredible things, and then they made things that other people didn't like. And then ironically, because they made the incredible thing, people were even meaner about the fact that they were imperfect and couldn't keep making incredible things. So I always give it, as many filmmakers as they can find it. It's not the easiest book to find, but I found it on eBay, and like you can find it. It's not impossible. Called Waiting on the Weather, and I really recommend it. While you're in your Zwick phase, I think you'd really like it.
Thank you. I'll definitely check it out. I've been reading nothing but filmmaker biographies over the past few years, and it's been really fun. Listen, people need to watch Lisa Frankenstein. Like I said, it's on VOD everywhere. Support the film. Check it out. Well, I know you want to work again. You're excited about it. And I know you want to write. I know you are writing actively. So
yeah, my next movie is one of mine.
That's fantastic. I was just going to say, obviously, you can't talk much about it.
It's in Italy. And it's this one is where I actually thought I was going to start before the kind of wacky comedy 80s. It's more along the lines of the 1960s Italian kind of suspense moment that happened.
Oh, my God. I can't wait.
So it's an Italian-based suspense thriller. Very different than Lisa, but it's where my heart lies in a lot of ways. I'm very fond of that whole era of... It's weird, too, because it's kind of a sexist era, but at the same time, it created some of the most incredible female icons of cinema. And so I love getting the chance as a woman to approach aspects of that, of like womanhood and sexuality in this very otherwise... male framed world, which I love. We'll see, but it's actually going to be filmed in Italy, which I'm very excited.
Oh, that's great. I'm extremely excited that you're a voice working not just in movies but in genre movies, and that you're going to continue to have stuff being made. It's just great. Again, Zelda Williams, it was a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time, and like I said, guys, check out Lisa Frankenstein. It's awesome.
Thanks, Chris.